because it was from Davies. Davies or Packless, that's good. Probably a document written in the 80s. Hebrews 11, the original 80s, not the 1980s. Maybe later, though. Hebrews 11, we're kind of cruising through our sermon series, Find Us Faithful. So we first talked about faith and good definitions of faith. There's lots of good ones. You can kind of do the ABCs. So faith is assurance, faith is belief, faith is conviction, faith is decision. Then we kind of leave the alphabet behind and we think about faith as risk, or faith as knowledge, faith as trust, faith as reliance. Those are all good. We talked a little bit about Abel and Enoch and Noah, those people that are helpers to us, those saints who encourage us, whether by their good example or maybe just by what we shouldn't do, right? Those people can help us in that way also. And then last week we talked about Abraham, his faithfulness to his call, and how he continued to step out in faith and in obedience and listening to what God was calling him to do. And so we pick up at verse 13, a little bit of an aside before we get back into Abraham. Hebrews was probably a sermon or a collection of sermons, and so even though the material in verses 13 through 16 is good, it sounds a little bit like we've forgotten we wanted to talk about Abraham, and we're kind of ready to move on, and then after that, kind of like, oh, back to Abraham, though. So I can resonate with this little passage here. So we'll pick it up in verse 13. Listen now for a word from God. All of these died in faith without having received the promises, but from a distance they saw and greeted them. They confessed that they were strangers and foreigners on the earth. But people who speak in this way make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. They had been thinking of the land that they had left behind. They would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God. Indeed, he has prepared a city for them. By faith, Abraham, when put to the test, offered up Isaac. He who had received the promises was ready to offer up his only son, of whom he had been told, "It is through Isaac that descendants shall be named after you." He considered the fact that God is able even to raise someone from the dead, and figuratively speaking, he did receive him back. By faith, Isaac invoked blessings for the future on Jacob and Esau. By faith, Jacob, when dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph, bowing in worship over the top of his staff. By faith, Joseph, at the end of his life, made mention of the exodus of the Israelites and gave instructions about his burial. The word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Let us pray. Holy God, we give you thanks for this time together. We thank you for each person here and what they mean to us, but moreover, what they mean to you. Help us to do something good with this time together. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, for you are our rock and our redeemer. Amen. So I was ordained in December of 2002, and in my first call, I served in Bowling Green, Kentucky, and it took me about 4 years to learn how to say Bowling Green right, because I'm an Ohioan, so, you know, I thought you were really supposed to pronounce all the letters in the word, but in Kentucky, you just don't have to do that. A lot of the letters are optional, so it took me a while to say Bowling Green the right way. I feel like I just need to tell you that, because it's an achievement I'm proud of. But I was an associate pastor for youth, and my full title, it should have said this, associate pastor for youth and college ministries and other duties as assigned, because that's kind of what I did. But I got a phone call one day, not too long after I'd been in the position, I got a phone call from my executive presbyter. Presbyterians do not have bishops, like maybe the Methodist Church or the Episcopal Church. So if you need to think of what an executive presbyter is like, if you in your mind could sort of make a hybrid between like a bishop and like a colonel in the military, that's probably pretty good. And since my executive presbyter at that time was former Army, it was perfect. So he called me on the phone and he said, "You will be going to the First Call seminar in February." And that's when I realized that really one of the great secrets of adulthood is to get people to do what you want, but in a way that makes them happy about it. Because once he told me that I was doing this, I wasn't that happy. Because I felt like, it's like, you may be a colonel, but I'm not a private, you know, I mean, this is not working out. So, but he could have said, you know, "Hey, Mike, there's this great thing coming up, and it's going to be in February, and it's going to be in Nashville, and we're going to put you up and pay for everything, and you have to attend, and there's going to be other young clergy from all over the synod, they're going to be there, it's going to be a lot of fun, and we just want to offer you this opportunity." But that's not what he did. He told me to do it, so I was kind of grouchy about it. And I was grouchy, and I'm sure I complained to Elizabeth about it for weeks and weeks. If it wasn't that, it was something else. So, at any rate, we showed up in Nashville, and it took me 35, 40 full minutes to get over it, and then I started having fun. Because it was young ordained clergy from the Synod of Living Waters, which was Kentucky and Tennessee and Alabama and Mississippi. A lot of us in our first call, all of us in our first call, you know, you get a bunch of young clergy together, and it's hard not to make the news. I mean, we just get up to some trouble, so it was a lot of fun. But I don't want to tell you about that now. Save that for another time. We had our speaker, our retreat preacher was J. Herbert Nelson, and J. Herbert Nelson is in effect, you call him the president of the Presbyterian Church USA. That's kind of what he is. But he wasn't, you know, he wasn't J. Herbert Nelson then. He was just J. Herbert Nelson. He was just a pastor. And so he got up in front of us one evening for worship, and he told this story, which I will try really hard not to absolutely ruin. He said that when he was a youngish pastor, he got called back to his home church to preach the funeral sermon of the beloved pastor who had been there forever. And so he agreed and traveled and went and preached the sermon, preached the funeral, and it must have gone well. And so afterward, he goes downstairs, goes into the pastor's office, you know, the old beloved pastor's office, and he was putting his robe in the little plastic bag that it likes to live in, and zipping it up, and all of a sudden he heard the door close. And he turned, and there were three people standing in the office. And he said, "Pastor, we are the unofficial nominating committee for this church, and we want you to consider being our new pastor." And now J. Herbert, tall guy, he's got to be 6'6", he kind of leans forward to all of us and says, "Time out. I just preached pastor's sermon, or pastor's funeral. His body's upstairs in the coffin. Body's upstairs. And these people come in and they want me to take his place." And he looked at all of us and he said, "So don't think for a minute they won't replace all of you." And that really struck me. I was like, am I Abraham in this story, or am I Isaac? I know I'm replaceable. So what does that mean? And you kind of have to grapple with that a little bit. This is a great text, and it's not a real good text for kids. I'm glad Karen brought her calculator and her ibuprofen and everything else, because it takes a while for us to really grapple with this text from Genesis. We understand that God takes care of us, but boy, this is sure set up like it doesn't work out so well, right? I remember the first time I ever had to preach Genesis 22. It was right after Noah was born. It was a very emotional endeavor. My new baby is home from the hospital, and now I have to talk about a guy who's going to kill his teenager on the hill. I kind of understand it now a little bit better, but still. Sorry, Noah. Sorry, that was too easy. Low-hanging fruit. Sorry, Noah. No, but it's a traumatic story. It's a text where you don't get all the details. Genesis 22 is really, it holds back. Everything is told in shadow. And it causes us to really lean in and lean forward And we want so much more detail than the storyteller is willing to give us. You know, we hear that Abraham is being tested, it's set up like that. And he said to him, Abraham, and Abraham says, here I am, God. And he said, take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love. The 11th century rabbi, Rashi, I believe his name was, get that book the right way. He did a great job sort of talking about this little passage where God says, you know, take your son, and Abraham says to him, I have two sons. And God says, you're only one. And Abraham says, well, this one is the only son of his mother, and this one is the only son of his mother. And God says, your son whom you love. And Abraham says, I love both of them. And finally, God has to say, Isaac. That's how the text reads, though, in the Hebrew word order. If you remember, it says, take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac. It's so beautiful the way the language just sort of stacks each of those descriptors. God is moving from the general to the more specific. Take your son, your only son. Or we as Christians would hear subtly in the background, your only begotten son. Take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the place that I will show you. Now, as Abraham is willing to venture out in faith, notice that in verse 6, and this is the kind of storytelling that's so masterful in the Hebrew Scriptures. Notice that it says, Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on his son Isaac. That's a little insulting. You have to carry your own wood. But maybe Isaac will feel better later on. It says, and Abraham himself carried the fire and the knife. Abraham is not going to let Isaac carry anything dangerous. Isaac cannot carry the fire. Isaac cannot carry the knife. Abraham won't let Isaac carry anything dangerous. He's gonna hold those risks in his hands as they go up. I think what the story is about for me, after all these years of kind of meditating on it, it's about where is our faith? Is our faith in what's before us? Is our faith in what we can do or what we can't do? Is our faith in our own resources, our own abilities? Or is our faith in God? Do we depend completely on what God can do and on what God says God can do? That's what I see in Abraham, that he's willing to completely depend upon God's word. His assurance, belief, conviction, decision, knowledge, trust, reliance, you name it, whatever your working definition is for faith, Abraham is all in on what God can do. He doesn't depend on Isaac to be the future. He doesn't look at Isaac and look at his shoulders and say, yes, this young boy can carry all my desires and hopes. God, Isaac's shoulders can carry the promise of the future. No, no, no. Isaac's shoulders are just broad enough to carry the wood. That's it. It's upon God's shoulders that everything else rests for Abraham. His faith, he's fully dependent upon God to make this happen. That's where his faith is. We had Presbytery last month. It was such a long time ago, I don't even remember where it was. Presbytery is kind of fascinating. If, as an elder, you ever get a chance to go to Presbytery, let me sell it to you a little bit. First of all, the coffee's not great, and the bananas are usually a little too green. But then, you know, we all get together, and you get to visit with other Presbyterians from around the area. And what I really like is that, you know, for your worship time, all the folks get together and they sing hymns. And, you know, Presbyterians can sing, so it's really good. It's really good to be together and hear everyone sing. And there's a worship service. And then usually you get to break up. At some point, you break up into small groups. So you're kind of wandering around this church you've never been in before, looking for people you've never seen before to hear about something you never heard before. It's great. And so we were there as we were breaking up into some different groups to talk about vital congregations, some different marks of vital congregations. And I went to this little session talking about, it was great. You know, when I tell you the name of this, you're going to say, of course you went to that. It's called Ecclesial Health. Ooh, yeah. Who knows what it was about, but it was a great name. So we talked about something. Go ahead and put up the slides. We talked about the four B's. The four B's. And these are the things that we can get hung up on. The first B is budgets. We can get hung up on budgets. How's the budget look? What did we budget? Well, what did we budget last year? Now you can easily get caught up on that, right? Then the next B was what? Survey says? Buildings, good, thank you. I could do it from memory, but I don't want to be out of order. So we talked about the building. Ooh, nightlights. You guys, if you haven't had your nap yet, it'll come after you have the pumpkin cake, okay? So we talked about buildings. What's the building like? Is the building meeting our needs? Oh, well, now my church, we decided we'd sell our building. We'd move into a storefront. Someone else next to me says, oh, we'd never sell our building. We talk about buildings. And then the next B, I have to make this kind of genteel. This one was behinds in the pews. Now, that's not the word he said. He didn't say that word, and I wasn't going to type that word. But we talked about, you know, who's there? Do we have enough people? Well, how do we get more people? And I wondered, is there like a powder, like a little powder where you could make more Presbyterians? Sort of like, you know, like powdered milk, powdered Presbyterians? I don't know. We talked about that. And the last one we talked about was, but we've never done it this way before. Oh, that's the last seven words of the church. We've never done it that way before, right? So, and I added one after a great elder training session last week. I added one, the bozo in the pulpit. Yeah. Steve Preston said bully pulpit, which I love that term, but I'm not much of a bully, but I am a lot of a bozo, so I'll take that action. So these five B's, you can get hung up on, right? You can get hung up on the building, right? You can have an edifice complex. You can get hung up on the budget. How much money do we have? Do we have enough? I don't know. Do we have too much? Yeah, we better give some of it away. We have too much. You can get hung up on that. Get hung up on how many people are here, right? You can get hung up on me, like, has he lost it? I think he's lost it. Oh, no, honey. He has never had it. You can do that. You can get hung up on all that stuff. That has absolutely nothing to do with faith. If we do all that, we're putting all of our hopes and promises and desires, we're trying to pin those on the church's shoulders, and the church has much too narrow shoulders for that. The church can barely carry the wood. All of our hopes, all of our desires, our future is with God, right? Everything, our faith, assurance, belief, conviction, decision, knowledge, trust, reliance, risk, all of that is with God. And that other stuff, you gotta have it. You know? You gotta have it. If we've all gotta go through couch cushions to pull out $2 more a week, then we've gotta do it. You know, I let the finance people deal with that. That's their spiritual gift. But my spiritual gift is to tell you that whatever happens, it's really with God. It's up to God. We have to be faithful to God. Let me close with a little story that I really love from the Irish philosopher and theologian Peter Rollins. He tells this little story about a pesky little atheist who was trying to refute a belief in God, a proof of God's existence. And he was a PhD student, and he wrote a very terrific dissertation, you know, really refuting a lot of classical arguments for the existence of God, and he of course, you know, passed and got an assistant teaching position, but he wasn't happy with what he wrote. He didn't do it all. He felt like there's still some ways that you could believe in God. So he, as a young faculty member, he wrote another book. He worked harder to try to really kind of nail down some other stuff, and it got a lot of acclaim. And he was asked to come to conferences and speak, but he felt like there were still areas kind of out there. Volume 2, it still left some things undone. So in his early 30s and 40s, he worked on another one. And, And again, the folks ate it up, and he was invited to big conferences now, and he could really, you know, ask for big speaking fees now, but it still didn't do it for him. He still felt like there were areas left up unexplored. And he kept doing that his whole career. And finally, toward the end of his career, he realized that maybe he only had one book left in him. And he was kind of working on that one night in his study. And he felt like this warm feeling kind of come over his whole body. And this voice speak to him, but not like an audible voice, like a voice he could hear in his heart. And it said, "My son, I have seen the work you have done. I have seen with what conviction, what faith you have done it with. But do you not know that you cannot complete this work without me? You need me in order to complete this work. So I will tell you a sacred mystery. I do not exist." Well, this weird smile came over the philosopher's face, and he shut his notebook, and he realized his work was finished. And he spent the rest of his life serving the poor. He realized what we all kind of know too, that it doesn't matter what we do. It doesn't rely on us. Everything relies on God. We depend totally on God today and tomorrow and forever.